This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. And, Dr. Hawk is missing today. So, Dr. Lyle, let's just get straight to the questions.
Okay.
How are you doing today?
Good. All is well up here.
All right, fantastic. Okay, so here we go. Dear Dr. Lyle, how much do you owe your parents as they age? My father's very disagreeable, and I hate being around him. He has embarrassed me many, many times throughout my life and always depended on me for his social life. He's cheated on my mother, was divorced 3 times, and is now alone in his 80s. I'm sure he is lonely, but as I said, I don't like being around him. I help him when he needs rides or other things, and he wants a social life with me, but I am bitter towards him for a number of things. I do feel guilty that I don't want to help him with his loneliness. I read the book you suggested, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Howie Brown, but a dilemma I have is that as my father ages, he will need me to care for him more, and I would like to move out of state. He does not have any savings to afford quality nursing home care. So the question is, do I need to take him with me because there would be no one else here to care for him?
Couple things, Nate, that I just want to let you know. You broke in and out on there when you were reading that, so hopefully it's fine on our recording. I would say the first part of the question asked how much do you owe your parents as they age, and the answer is you don't owe them anything. Okay, so the anything that you feel obligated to do. It should be coming from a place of gratitude for what it is that they did for you, and some feeling that they have earned credits with you, so that when now the shoe is on the other foot, and in this particular case, what's that? Excuse me.
Oh, my phone. I didn't say anything.
Okay. All right. So the notion is now when the shoe is on the other foot, and there is and now they need help, and they actually have no resources to pay their way or compensate us, then they had better obviously be hoping that we have great affection for them. Now, in many of our cases, that the answer is, I would say, probably most cases that's true. So most cases. You know, certainly a lot of people some number of people have had really badly conflicted and nasty and maybe abusive processes between them and their parents. That's not the typical pattern, but it certainly exists in the world. And those are, you know, obviously unfortunate circumstances. And so if you have that situation, then obviously that this can be, there could be some sort of conflicts running around in somebody's head about how they feel about the person. Even in abusive situations, a lot of times a person who is even abused as a child can have a very conflicted situation with respect to an abusive parent, just because it wasn't all abuse. There sometimes, you know, there's a very mixed bag of essentially costs and benefits that went along a long-term process. So the relationship is a complicated, conflictual mess, and that remains potentially in place when the parent is aged and infirmed and has no resources, and a child with obviously that has an adult child that has more resources now is looking at a situation and trying to decide, you know, what it is that they want to or feel like they should somehow give. Now, this case doesn't sound like it was like that. It was just unpleasant and nasty and conflicted behind a highly disagreeable man. And so my very first pass is, you don't owe him anything at all. And I'm not sure why it is that you're giving him rides and doing this, possibly out of feeling like the village may look at you and basically has some sort of a recording process, obviously, in the minds of the village that would be watching you about how it is that you treat this aged parent who is now, you know, in these circumstances and has nobody else. And so maybe that is a motivation, which is a completely legitimate motivation to protect your own standing in the village, i.e. the assessment that the village would have of you. That can be visited with guilt. In other words, guilt can be essentially the internal audience is watching you, and therefore it's got an opinion about this, and therefore it's signaling some degree of disturbance and possible disgust if you don't hustle and give up some of your time and energy and money or whatever resources that you have to this aging parent. So that's what Freud would call superego. It's the same concept as an internal audience that is signaling to you that the cost that you may be imposed on you by the village if the village was to observe that you abandon this person. Now, and so that we can't necessarily worm our way around that. Those are innate structures, and we may not be able to essentially recalibrate the internal audience's view of the situation. I don't know if we can or we can't. I'm just tough enough and nasty enough that I would not be intimidated by the village's view if I abandoned a parent that had been my relationship with the parent. My attitude would be, I'm enough of a free enterprise libertarian that my attitude would be, you know, you had 80 years, and there was an awful lot of days when the sun was shining, when there was money for you to be made, and that you could have saved it and you could have taken care of business. And now you don't have anything. And now you also don't have any friends, and you don't really have any credit with me because of who it is that you are. Sorry, I'm living by the disagreeable distance rule, and you're disagreeable and I'm not helping. You're going to have to find another way. And so that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that in plain English to the person, but I would say it with my behavior. So I would, of course, just out of sort of general compassion for any animal, I would try to help them problem solve to some degree. I wouldn't feel it incumbent on me to actually solve the problem, but I would certainly help assist them. So if this guy is 80 years old and he's got Social Security and he's got $1,350 a month, and he's getting trapped by financial considerations, and he can't, he's going to be in trouble. Well, first of all, if he has any resources at all, he can live in a board and care. And he doesn't need to go anywhere. He doesn't need a ride for anything. You can get public transportation. So I would, if this were my parent and I didn't like them and they were disagreeable and difficult, I would keep my distance and basically act as a social worker. And I would actually be pretty soon a social worker one step removed, so that I'd actually have a real live social worker or somebody equivalent, senior assistant people, et cetera, that he could call. And I'd give him you have a list of phone numbers on speed dial on some phone in the house where he could hit those numbers and talk to Mabel down there, who's supposed to tell him, you know, when he's supposed to pick up his bus. Okay. So I would not, by any stretch of the imagination, cramp my style about where it is that I was going to move to. You say you're moving out of state. That individual wouldn't particularly be welcome to follow me. They would be welcome to. It's a free country, so if they want to move and be within a few miles of me in the Borden care, that's 3 miles away, that's fine. But don't count on me dropping anything to come over and help you. In fact, you can probably count on me stopping by and giving you, I don't know, a box of chocolates, you know, or something equivalent every couple of weeks. and chatting with you for 15 or 20 minutes. That's probably about what I would do. Okay, so I'm just not going to let such an individual swallow very many of the hours of my life. And the fact that they have painted themselves into a personal and financial corner is, you know, that's okay. Those were choices that they made, and these are the consequences that they face, and these are not dire. I look at people's lives. I project their life against a backdrop of the nature of life as it has existed for human beings for a million years. And an 80-something-year-old man who has Medicare, so therefore he's got perfectly outstanding medical care relative to all of the medical care that ever took place in all of humanity for all time, except that no, whatever he gets at Medicare right now is not the Mayo Clinic. Fair enough. Okay? The Medicare that he gets today is better than what the Mayo Clinic could have given him 40 years ago. So that is going to have to do. So he has outstanding medical care by any reasonable measure. He has plenty of food because he's not going to starve. There's no possible way to starve in this country unless you don't know where the food bank is or where the free food is. So that is impossibility. He does not have to be cold or hot. Okay, he can be in a board and care room somewhere with Horace and Mabel down, you know, that run the thing, and he can be in perfectly reasonable circumstances. If he is so inherently disagreeable that he gets kicked out of Horace and Mabel's, then he can go over to, I don't know, Bert and Alice's. Okay, they'll take him because they've got a vacancy. So the point is that they're extremely well protected, better than in any teepee. Okay. Or any place in Mesa Verde, any place, you know, in Egypt, prior to 1900. In other words, basically, he can live in outstanding circumstances with probably cable television and probably can afford a cell phone and can have completely comfortable air conditioning and heating and has nice sheets of at least 400 thread count and has a TV to watch with all kinds of free stuff on it. Quite frankly, I don't really care that he doesn't have any money. He's got enough resources to survive and survive very, very well relative to how human beings have survived throughout their natural history. So now, what kind of help is it that is he going to need? Oh, now he's suddenly incapacitated and he has to be, you know, in a home because he has to be hauled out of his bed in order to go to the bathroom. Oh, well. He's not going to live in my house, for God's sakes. He's going to wind up in a Social Security mediated nursing home. Fair enough. Okay, so that's how that is. That's what the society has for him. This is not a tragedy. Okay, I've worked in some of those places, and they are, you know, from my standpoint, as an able-bodied, you know, 40-year-old walking into those places. The smell of them and the clinical attitude and the kind of like not too hop to it on the staff part. And you've got these little old people lying up in bed and they're pretty feeble. It's not an inspiring, happy place, but it is the life that's the best we can do. And, 100 years from now, the standard will be somewhat better, than it is now. But this is the standard that exists now. And that standard is not really physically uncomfortable because of the ecological circumstances. What's physically uncomfortable is whatever infirmities the person has and the limitations that they have. That's really the problem. And there's really nothing to be done about that problem. So, quote, better medical care isn't going to fix it. You know, the little old person that's in deep trouble and is sick and has got some chronic degenerative disease, you know, we're not going to fix it with an Esselstyn diet, you know, and some extra carrot sticks at this point. That's never going to happen. Okay, this person's in trouble and they are infirmed and we're not going to get some big improvement in the diet. And even if we did, it wouldn't make much difference at that point. So, you know, this is a long rant on this question, but what I'm trying to explain to this person and try to give them at least my frame from my standpoint is a person that I believe is probably sitting right about in the middle of the bell curve for disagreeable. And that is, you know, I would give them the time and attention that I feel like that they have earned and deserved. And in the case of my mother is a fabulous human being, and my mother lives with me. Okay, so that means when she calls out in the middle of the night for me, I get up. Okay, and that may be three times a night. And that's been going on for a year. And if it goes on another 3 years, it goes on another 3 years. Because that little, lovely, incredible lady deserves it. Okay? So this individual, if that individual had been my father, no dice. Okay? So you a disagreeable distance goes all the way to the grave. So we don't have to... we don't have to abandon people, and we don't have to get pissy with them. We just set limits and boundaries that work for us. That essentially the conflict isn't between you and your father. It's between you and your internal audience. It's really about you analyzing in your own mind what's fair and not being intimidated by what others might think of what is fair. Instead, try to zero in with your own conscience about what you think is fair. And from my standpoint, from what I'm hearing about this, what's fair is the closest you get is 2-3 miles away, and I'm going to drop by twice a month for 15 minutes and a box of chocolates. That's fair, okay? And all the other financial issues and all the other wheelchairing that he needs and all the other stuff, that's for somebody else to do, not you. All right.
Wonderful, Dr. Lyle. Thank you very much.
You bet.
All right.
What else we got?
Our next question. Dear doctors, I'm having environmental issues, and I'm really stuck as to what to do about it. I have a 36-year-old special needs daughter. For the most part, she eats what I put in front of her, but adamantly says no to going full-on plant-based. She still wants occasional meat and also cookies with her coffee in the afternoon. This is so embarrassing, but every chance I get, I sneak into her room and grab some cookies or candy or whatever else she has stashed in there away from mom. It's really hindering my progress. I almost think it's psychological on my part. Every time I go below 200, I sabotage myself and I'm just lingering between 198 and 202. I get so down on myself. I know you shouldn't beat yourself up over a slip-up, but geez, this has been going on for so long.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, it's not, quote, psychological. Okay. So you have a tremendous set of integrated circuitry that you're going to find in something as simple as a honeybee. Okay. That is going to guide you to the richest food in the environment. So that is the story of the pleasure trap is a story of a rejection of the notion that there are some nefarious and opaque psychological reasons that cause us to, quote, self-sabotage and eat rich foods. Do you understand? Eating rich foods is not self-sabotage. It's frickin' survival. Okay? Your nervous system is designed by nature to run cost-benefit analysis on algorithms that were built for a Stone Age environment. When you eat the Cheetos, you are doing the smartest thing that brain can figure out what to do. There is no better move in the house unless there's Oreos. And there's no better moves than that unless there's, I don't know, chocolate cheesecake. Then that's a better move. So to think that this is self-sabotage is ludicrous, or that it's, quote, psychological, and that's ludicrous, and that there's a barrier to you going under 200 because somehow you won't allow yourself to do this. This is all completely and utter, you know, psychobabble fantasy. It has nothing to do with the truth. The truth of the matter is that if you have rich food in the environment, you're like a ferret, okay? And you're going to find it. That's what it is. So now the question is, what do we want to do about this? And so we have all kinds of range of alternatives. So one thing, we could sit in a yogi position and chant and then go on to some online, you know, hotshot that's going to tell us how to focus, you know, and focus on your deep breathing so that then, you know, then you'll get rid of that, those cravings. Okay. That won't work. Okay. So that's out. Okay. So what are our alternatives? Well, another alternative, if we're talking to our good chef, Abby J, she'd probably say, what's the crap doing in the house? Oh, but my daughter has special needs and she really likes it. So what's she going to do? Okay. How's she going to go down to the store and get her own coffee and donuts? Doesn't sound like that's probably able for her to happen. So understand that you are in dictatorial control over what's in that house, and you can monitor what's in there, and whatever is so enticing to you, you don't have to bring it in there. And if we hear some squawking from the special needs child, oh well. So there's some squawking. They'll only squawk so long, and then they'll quit squawking. Okay, that's because they're designed by nature to run a cost-benefit analysis on how much time and energy to put into complaining. And after they complain for long enough and they don't get any results, then it quiets down. Okay, that's how life works. Now someone might say, oh my God, that would be terrible. You know, we can't do that. This person, you know, is caught in the pleasure trap, and they really want these foods, and they've got it in their head, and then they're going to squawk and squawk, and you know how terrible of us to only let them eat the bounty of nature, of all the possible natural foods and healthy foods that are in the environment, and not let them eat the drug-like foods that are in the environment. So that would be a just terrible abuse. I could just hear it out of about a bunch of social workers now telling me, you know, and a bunch of, what do you call it? I could just see Doug Lyle getting canceled as a psychologist for saying that it would be perfectly reasonable to do nothing other than bring whole natural foods in your house. Yeah, that is a totally reasonable solution to this problem.
You monster.
Now, well, let's suppose that we think, well, that's a little too far for us. We feel like, you know, these are treats, and this individual doesn't have that much excitement in her life or some such thing, and which is probably not the case, but maybe it is, or maybe that's your perception. So maybe we're going to do this. Well, then fine. Do it on a limited basis. So bring home a sack of Oreos, you know, every Saturday, and set some down in front of your daughter and lay a bunch of them around the house, and, you know, you'll get your share, and then that's it. No more for the rest of the week. And you tell your daughter, this is our sack of Oreos for the week. In fact, maybe you keep it in your room and then go sneak in there when she's not looking and get your share. See if you can get a row. Okay. But the truth is, that's all you're going to get this week. All right. So big deal. This isn't going to stop us mythically at 201 pounds. One row of Oreos is not going to keep you over 200 pounds. So that's what I would tell you. So the notion is you've got all kinds of options. The yogi and the hypnotism isn't going to work. Because you're fighting deep instinctual algorithms that are going to get you into that room and slip past the burglar alarm that your daughter has set, and you will get your share. Okay, that is going to happen. So the only question is, what is your share? Maybe it's not that great. Maybe it's kind of whole natural oriented, you know, healthier junky food that you don't really like that much. Good, good. So maybe that's what we bring in the house, and it's not that enticing. But your daughter still gets to smack her lips over it. She likes it pretty well, and that's that. Or maybe what we do is we bring in the really good junky stuff, but we only do it on a very limited basis. And that's and then there is no food to be sneaking into her room to get. So the only reason we have a problem is we're bringing home truckloads of this stuff. That's what's happening. And if you're bringing home truckloads of that stuff, and it's in there all the time, and you know it's in there, then we can expect that your Stone Age brain will have mapped out the environment. It knows where the bathroom is, knows where the kitchen is, it knows where the trash can is, and believe me, it knows where your daughter's room is, and it knows where she's got the stuff. It would be a moronic system that did not know, okay? So it knows, it's never going to not know, it's never going to not be motivated, and so therefore, I would suggest that we acknowledge that openly and straight up, and we understand that the kind of solutions that I'm talking about are the only reasonable solutions we've got.
Yeah, wonderful, Dr. Lyle. It's it's always a pleasure to hear you rant on the pleasure trap.
All right.
I recently had a patient, and we actually discussed shredding his credit card and putting all his money in the bank so that he couldn't access it. So he couldn't get food, you know, the food that he wanted to get.
Right.
We ended up brainstorming that maybe someday in the future, you know, you'll be able to tie your whatever Alexa or Amazon account or whatever.
Yeah.
It won't let you actually buy nothing but fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Yes. Who knows? We'll give somebody good luck with that app. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Our next question. Dear doctors, I'm a high 90th percentile in all the categories of personality. I believe that my high conscientiousness often protects me from the negative aspects of being emotionally volatile, as I have high standards of behavior for myself and others. However, even being reasonable, intelligent, caring, etc., I'm easily thrown off by simple things at work or in my personal life, and I'm a crier. As an example, I share an office in the work-from-home world right now with my mom. The office is connected to my house, and yesterday she brought me candied ginger, which I love. I ate about a quarter of it, and I didn't want to get caught in the pleasure trap with the rest, so I put it in my compost bin. Well, this morning she happened to go brush my cat, and after she put the hair in the compost, she saw the ginger and got upset that I threw away any of it. After explaining to her that I really enjoyed it, I just didn't want to keep the rest around the house, she kept going on that yes, she wanted me to be happy, but she thought that I cared about not being wasteful. For the record, it cost $5. I didn't get over it for over an hour and kept involuntarily crying because I was so upset that I disappointed her. I understand this sort of thing is my esteem meter for people I love, but I don't recalibrate quickly from negative feedback, and I'd like to learn how to get better at it. I'm 31 and overall successful in work and relationships, but I'm too darn sensitive.
Interesting. Obviously, this is one of these cases where we're trying to extrapolate from very little data. So the person speaks in a lot of generalities. They've given us one specific instance, and that one specific instance is it's a little muddy about how to score it, you know, as I'm trying to look down on this thing from a 1,000-foot view. The mother's response seems, her response, first of all, seems very reasonable. In other words, yeah, I threw it out, but this is why, etc. Okay, so the mother's response is curiously argumentative, okay? Which is sort of like, yeah, but I thought you didn't want to be wasteful. Okay, as if this is some character trait that has been discussed and analyzed and organized along a continuum of virtue. And so the fact that the mother would bring it up is indicative of quite a high degree of disagreeability. So the way that thing essentially should go, if the mother was a reasonable down the middle person, it would be, hey, the reason I didn't do that is because this, that, or the other. It would be like, okay, I got it. Okay. I could see the mom saying something like, well, gee, maybe next time, take half or a quarter. Okay. Something like that. And then to be like, yeah, that's a good idea. But to essentially go after and criticize this individual, essentially criticize her conscientiousness as a characterological sort of attack, that's kind of shitty, quite frankly. And so, like I said, I'm extrapolating here, but that a flag goes up in my head that says, disagreeable. Okay, now that's important, and let me tell you why. Because we're not going to change you. We're not going to make you tougher. We're not going to make you more resilient. This is all fantasy for, you know, some other therapist. No, what we're going to do, this is straight out of Jen Hawk's potted plant. Okay, you got to think of yourself as a potted plant, and the control we have is where we place the potted plant. It isn't changing the plant's characteristics. So, we have to recognize that with your mother. Okay, we just found a possible conflict of interest between you and your mother. Your mother's trying to do a nice thing, and right away you know you're a little uncomfortable with it. Okay, so we know this because we know that you're going to go to a fair amount of trouble to self-discipline yourself and try to get rid of this stuff on the sly. It's like, so you know at the moment that this is happening, this is a conflict of interest. And so what we do with these people like this is, you know, this is a sort of an unfortunate little mess. But what we can do with disagreeable people that we're close to is we have to essentially hammer out, you know, if we've got repetitive types of issues or repetitive specific issues, we can try to hammer out agreements and see if they'll honor them, okay? If they won't honor them, then we have to move back and we have to get less, we have to essentially increase the distance. So we're a potted plant. So we can try to negotiate with the gardener. And then if it turns out that the gardener, we can't negotiate them with, well, no problem. Then we move a little further away. You know, we don't have to like go to the other side of the country, but we have to do things like, hey, maybe we're not going to work in the same office, or, you know, there's some boundaries here. Don't bring me any food because I've got my own designs on how I think about food. And so, you know what? I know you, I appreciate your thought, and I really do. I appreciate your caring and concern and wanting to do nice things for me, but you know what? It's a problem. So just don't. Okay. So we set that boundary, and then we should never have that problem again. And so by the time we, with somebody that may be a little disagreeable or a little pushy, by the time we set half a dozen boundaries, if they're a super important person that's a big fixture in our life, we'll see whether or not they can hold those boundaries. Now, if they can't, oops, too bad, then don't try to change them. We just change the distance. Okay, that's how we're going to fix it, because they can't be fixed. They can't be negotiated with. Now, I have no idea what the gal's mother's like, whether or not she actually can be pretty reasonable, whether or not we can set a boundary with her, and then she's going to respect it. But the notion is that we're not going to change. So we're going to have to reduce by structuring the social interactions between us and others. We're going to have to reduce the likelihood of us getting pushed into those situations. And that's all we can do. Okay? So if you're a sensitive soul, then we have to put you, you know, we got to maneuver you to pleasant enough situations that you can function quite well. And that's the best advice I've got.
Wonderful.
All right.
All right.
Dr. Lyle, how do you feel?
I think we got room for one more.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. Our final question. Dear Dr. Lyle, you discussed on the podcast a situation where a person feels depressed because they feel they are not motivated to work diligently on their goals. I have a similar but slightly different situation where I am very happy with my life. I have a dream job, good performance reviews, good pay, and so I should be happy. But I know that I'm not fully applying myself at work and that I'm cruising at about 50% effort. As a result, I feel constant guilt for slacking off at work, and I can't seem to force myself to work harder. The boss is happy, and unless there is an immediate and heavy deadline, I really don't feel motivated. This puzzles me because I really do love my job, and I would even happily do this work for free. By the way, I work for a government agency, and the work is quite analytical. Some would say it's ADHD, but I know evolutionary psychology doesn't recognize ADHD. Can you talk about this phenomenon, please?
That's actually a very interesting problematic situation, and the solution is actually to run experiments so that the person can educate their own nervous system about the value of earning self-esteem. So the self-esteem mechanism is raising one eyebrow in disgust at this individual, and that's why they're feeling guilty. Okay, they're also the internal audience is observing the mediocrity of effort and is aware actually of the following. The because he knows, he or she knows, that a mediocre effort is being made, then they also know that they could be found out. So, okay, just because you're fooling the village, as far as you can tell, you are not fooling everybody. And even if you think you're fooling everybody, you are aware that because you are in fact flaking out, that someone could ultimately find this out. Now, that isn't any big tragedy. I mean, I worked in the prison system and I saw unbelievably lazy people. I saw staggering waste of government money. We had one guy by the name of John, and please, no Johns need to be offended by this, because a lot of people in the world, their name is John. But John was an old social worker. He was probably in his 60s. And I hope some people out there that know me and might be connected with me know who this guy is, because he deserves to be called out. This guy was the laziest, most worthless human being I've ever met in my life. I met serial killers that I had more respect for than this guy. This guy got more pay for less effort than anybody. And I found out later that he would never be let go, because it turned out he was an interior snitch. So he actually would go up and talk to the brass about anything anybody else was doing, apparently. Very self-righteous dude. And anyway, so this guy, one day we knew that we had these big inspectors coming from Sacramento. There was a long story. There was a little crisis, and the office of the inspector general was going to come to my prison, and they were going to sweep through there. And we all knew that this was happening. So all of us, you know, made extra sure that we're going to be looking like we were working. So this guy, John, turns out he's a big rotund guy, and he would kick back in his chair at his desk, and he would just throw his head back and sleep. This was a daily event that would go on for hours, and he would like snore, all right? I know this is hard to believe, but it's true. So anyway, you know, I wasn't anywhere near him, so I didn't have to see this happen very often. But every now and then, I would walk over to where he worked, and there he'd be with his head back, snoring. Anyway, so here's the Office of the Inspector General, who's actually coming to do some report on, it's actually a report on the fact that a lot of people were clocking in late, and so therefore they thought that we weren't working that hard. So, of course, everybody was going to hustle around, make sure that they look like they're working. And what do we find? John, when the inspector general came in, was in his chair with his head back sleeping. You gotta love that, man.
Couldn't even put it together for that.
Oh, no, not even going to put it together for the inspector general. So anyway, what was I going to say? So this guy had no internal audience that could care, because he had a big narcissistic streak. So he figured he was doing us a big favor just by being there, apparently. Now, this individual here, our person who wrote, actually has a little guilt chip in their head. And they understand that in a government agency with everything swimming along just fine, everybody's working half time. Obviously, the money's better than they deserve relative to a private enterprise job. And everything's Jake. And he actually likes kind of some of the work that he or she does, whatever it is. So in some ways, it looks like a dream job. But actually, of course, it's not. And the reason it's not is because it's ripe for essentially termites constantly gnawing away at your self-esteem. So you feel like someone who is, got a little counterfeit machine. that you're actually cheating and getting away with it, and it's a little bit giddy to cheat. But at the same time, it feels morally incomplete. So they're not completely way over the line here. They're not actually counterfeiting money, but they're doing something pretty close. They're basically stealing taxpayer money. They're getting paid. This individual's getting paid twice as much as they deserve because they're only working a half time. So what do I think about this? Well, it really isn't for me to have any input into how to analyze this thing from any sort of moral objective at all. The real issue is the moods of happiness inside of that nervous system. And we're seeing a conflict. In other words, part of it giddy, part of it perfectly pleased with the bit of work that they are doing, part of it feeling the footsteps of the village discovery, and that the game will be up and that they'll all have to quit being naughty, naughty mice or naughty school kids with the teacher gone and effectively buckle down. Okay. What I would say is I would say that I would run an experiment and I would say, okay, you know what? Let's start with 3 days. Let's see if you can discipline yourself for 3 days to get there on time, work effectively, don't stay out for a long lunch, and work the way to the end bell and actually do your very best. And I would be doing that for just one purpose. And that purpose is to observe whether or not you notice the internal audience change its feedback to you. I think even one day you might see a change. After 3 days, that's not a very complicated experiment. It's a 24-hour experiment. Those 24 hours might be an interesting revelation as to how your own mechanics work. Of course, the energy conservation system is delighted to try to game a system. Animal life is all about every possible shortcut that we can figure out. That's why you have eyes, okay? Eyes are a shortcut, so you don't have to wander all over the landscape blind to try to find the materials you need to survive or to find a mate or to follow the sound or the smell of them. No, you can see them, okay? Your entire sensory system is all about energy conservation. So is your memory system. It's about energy conservation. Everything about you is built around the principle of energy conservation. And so it's no surprise that if you have a job that is rigged out of the free enterprise system without any competitive pressure, that the government has carved out a bunch of money outside of the real cost-benefit analytics that sit inside and drive the market, that people sit inside government positions that are overpaid and underworked and are basically scamming, okay? Now that happens in private enterprise as well. It's not like that's all clean and dandy, but it's particularly rampant in government. That's because there's no competitive pressures. In free enterprise, you have a company and you have a hierarchical structure, and people have expected numbers that every person in middle management understands that they are being judged on what their team below them accomplishes, and they're being compared to similar people in the organization, et cetera. So, or over time, what is reasonable to be accomplished, et cetera. And this is all being organized under the heading of profit motive, and it's being analyzed by stockholders or the ownership, et cetera. So there's competitive pressures that sit inside a normally functioning competitive enterprise that will make this type of thing impossible. Like I said, it is impossible because there's all kinds of quirky distortions in systems all over the place. But the distortions are rampant in government because the competition has been removed. And this is why, Tony Soprano, this was all about getting the contract for the waste management in New Jersey. Like, that's what it's all about. Okay, it's the mob's like, listen, we want a government contract. Of course we do. We want twice as much money as we need to do the job. And so so that just is what it is. And so this individual, is not in any unique circumstances. They're in particularly good circumstances because they happen to like the bit of work that they do. And they're being actually well paid. Most government jobs aren't super well paid. They're just pretty well paid. But they seem very happy about it, which means that they are aware that they would not be getting more money under private enterprise, or they wouldn't be singing their praises about the pay. Okay, so so what we're hearing is a very cushy set of circumstances, very unusual, and what we're seeing is the termites gnawing away at the person's life experience behind the self-esteem mechanism. So I would say, why not run an experiment? For 3 days, do an outstanding job, not just a decent job, do a really good job. Like just you know, put on your best, you know, tie or clothes and go in there and get serious and do a really good job. And just see what it feels like, okay? And what I can tell you is that's what work can feel like. So in some other universe somewhere, that if you have skills that translate into the private marketplace, somewhere there is a position that feels like that, okay? And then you can decide, you can run a better cost-benefit analysis on how to spend your life as to whether or not we want to spend it, you know, in any different ways. We can do a better job at our government job. We can go ahead and continue to essentially cut corners and let the energy conservation system run rampant and just, you know, cruise around and deal with a little bit of low-grade guilt. That's not a terrible outcome. We also may find that the feeling of actually doing it as well as we can figure out how to do it and to do it really well throughout the entire day, we're like, huh, that's interesting. And you may not be able to force yourself to do that in a government position because a lot of that process is taking place as a result of the external structure of the profit motive and competition, which sounds unpleasant, but quite frankly, it is in fact the state of nature. And so that's why animals in a zoo are not as happy as their wild animal counterparts. Now, they live longer, which is why government workers live a lot longer than... I'm just kidding. No. The truth of the matter is that obviously animals in a zoo live a lot longer, animals in captivity, because they're not being eaten by predators and they don't have, you know, accidents and getting bit and get infected or whatever else that is under the sun. But they aren't as happy. And so consider just how happy you are and experiment with a different way of doing things. And then, you know, look around this problem. Obviously, you would never leave a cushy situation unless you have awfully good reason to leave it. But, you know, there may be a time when you decide that, you know, it's a little too flat and maybe you want to change something up in a way that will enhance your life.
Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. This ties in so beautifully to the last episode that we had with the how to do the hard things you know you should do, because mm-hmm. You know, 3 days seems like such a more reasonable start for someone who may be kind of deep in the doldrums of mm-hmm. of this lack of productivity. So really, really appreciate it, Dr. Lyle. Thank you so much.
You bet.
All right, Nathan. We'll wrap it up and we'll talk to you and hopefully Dr. Hawk next show.
Oh, we absolutely will. We can't wait to have her back.
All right. Very good. Have a wonderful night, Dr. Lyle.
Great, Nathan. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.